What's the dish?
Hello and welcome back to the Food Safety Dish, a production brought to you by National Farmers Union's Local Food Safety Collaborative. I'm your host, Catherine Kavanaugh, and today Haley and I are diving into seaweed-filled waters with seaweed food safety specialist Anushka Concepcion. Anushka is going to help us navigate the scene of America's seaweed production and the food safety issues present in various levels of the seaweed supply chain. First, let's share a little background on what seaweed is and its place in the American market. Seaweed is technically any red, green, or brown marine algae that grows along coastal shores and normally is anchored to the seafloor or some other solid structure. Seaweed only attaches at its base and does not extract any kinds of nutrients from it. The wide variations in seaweed are a result of the depth, salinity, and UV light levels. The three main classifications of seaweed, red, green, or brown, are further divided into subcategories. Here's a fun fact. A common misconception is that kelp and seaweed belong to different genus or, in other words, are unrelated, but kelp is actually the largest subgroup of seaweed. Kelp is classified as a brown algae and has nearly 30 genera or types. Kelp, like many other types of seaweed, can be farmed and harvested for human and animal consumption. There are 10 main types of edible seaweed, from the red algae class nori, Irish moss, and dulse, from the green algae class mikabu and umibudo, and finally from the brown algae class kombu, wakame, arame, and hijiki. The first three are types of kelp. These various types of edible seaweeds can be seen in coastal cuisines all around the world, including China, Japan, Korea, Iceland, Norway, and Wales, in dishes like sushi, miso soup, seaweed salad, lava bread, and carrageenan moss pudding. Seaweed is also extremely versatile and can be used in other areas such as in beverages, agriculture, animal feed, cosmetics, personal care, and medicine. Seaweed is gaining popularity in the American market and has become increasingly commercialized. The U.S. production of seaweed has increased from just 17 tons in 2017 to 440 tons in 2021, with output expected to grow tremendously. The U.S. seaweed production hotspots are located in Maine, which harvested 1.2 million pounds in 2022, California, which harvests between 100,000 and 170,000 pounds a year, and Alaska, which harvested more than 112,000 pounds in 2019. The American market is evolving to incorporate more seaweed production and processing, especially as consumers demand more organic and natural products. Yet, the U.S.'s seaweed production and global market share is relatively small. For example, the global seaweed market produces an estimated 35.8 million tons annually, of which 97% is produced in Asian countries. Seaweed is an important commodity and is starting to play a larger role in American markets. As seaweed production and consumption increases, it is crucial to be aware of the challenges and food safety issues that can arise from growing to harvesting to processing. Now that we have a better understanding of what seaweed is and the role it plays in the American markets and with consumers, let's anchor down and talk all about food safety. Anushka Concepcion is an associate extension educator focusing on marine aquaculture with the Connecticut Sea Grant Program based at the UConn Avery Point campus in Groton, Connecticut. She is also a faculty member at UConn's Department of Cooperative Extension. Her programming focuses on supporting marine aquaculture stakeholders in Connecticut, including the nascent seaweed aquaculture industry and associated stakeholders. Concepcion collaborates with industry and regulators to address emerging challenges associated with seaweed aquaculture. Specifically, she assists with the development of guidance on potential human health hazards associated with seaweed grow-out and processing, market development, and permitting. She conducts one-on-one consultations with prospective aquaculture producers regularly, conducts research to address emerging stakeholder needs, organizes workshops for industry and general audiences, and presents at various research conferences. She earned a BS degree in marine biology from the University of North Carolina at Wilmington and an MS in fisheries, animal, and veterinary sciences from the University of Rhode Island. Between earning degrees, Concepcion worked at Shrimp Improvement Systems LLC in the Florida Keys, where she managed microalgal production for the nursery facility. She leads the National Seaweed Hub, a collaborative effort of 11 Sea Grant programs and their stakeholders, which addresses the emerging needs of the national seaweed aquaculture industry. She also serves on the steering committee for the Safe Seaweed Coalition, a global partnership supported by the United Nations Global Compact and Lloyd's Register Foundation, and on the board of directors for the nonprofit organization Minorities in Aquaculture. Concepcion is passionate about providing the world's population with responsibly produced food through aquaculture. Anushka, welcome to the Food Safety Dish. We're delighted to have you here today.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm happy to be here.
Awesome. Well, let's dive right into the waters of seaweed. And let's start by talking about seaweed in its natural environment. Can you tell us what ecosystem services, habitat, and diversity of functions does it provide?
So seaweeds, they're also called macroalgae. They are part of a healthy ecosystem. And there are hundreds of different types of seaweeds that provide various functions, including habitat for organisms. There's some species that can act as wave attenuators. So that means they sort of help buffer wave action on coastlines. And there's other species that provide food for other organisms, but also food for us. There are three types of seaweeds, the reds, browns, and greens. And the colors designate the type of photosynthetic compounds that they contain in their tissues that give them the color that we see. Seaweeds absorb nutrients right out of the water column. And so the nutrients in the water serves as a type of natural fertilizer. And because of that effect that seaweed has on water, there's also a lot of research investigating the practicalities of using seaweed to remove high levels of nutrients in some coastal waterways. So to summarize, there are a lot of functions seaweeds have, many of which that are natural, a part of the ecosystem, but there's also things that seaweeds can do that can provide a lot of benefits to human beings as well.
Thanks for sharing. You mentioned this earlier. So seaweed goes by many names, seaweed, macroalgae. We've also heard kelp and sea greens. Are they all the same thing? Or if they're not, how do you distinguish between all the different kinds of seaweeds there are?
Yeah. So generally, they are pretty much all the same thing. Some people use them interchangeably, but seaweed, I think, is more of an umbrella term for all the species. For example, kelp is a type of seaweed. It is a brown seaweed.
Okay.
And then sea greens is a name that was created by the culinary industry, denoting that there are certain species that are used for human food. So not all seaweeds would be sea greens, which means we can't eat. Not all seaweeds are edible. Also, not all seaweeds are kelp or brown. So I think it would just be the type of application and also the type of species. So just really to summarize, I prefer to use either seaweed when I want to be general about talking about lots of different types. But then I'll use kelp when I'm only talking about kelps. And there's multiple species of kelp as well. So if I want to be general about that type of seaweed or that species or set of species, I should say. Just to give you an example, there are other types of edible species, as I mentioned. One is called dulse, and that's a red seaweed. And that's also known as the bacon of the sea because it has very high level of protein. And then there's a lot of interest in utilizing dulse, especially for vegans, to sort of give them that salty, crunchy, but high-packed protein type of food product. And so that's what's important for me, not to really misinform or confuse folks who may have certain expectations when they hear the word seaweed, but also with their potential uses. So not all seaweeds are created equally. So yeah, that's the reason why I like to be specific, but at the same time, not too scientific and not too technical.
Okay. Thanks for clarifying.
Sure.
I'm glad you talked a little bit about different uses seaweed can have. And I wanted to kick off a question about harvesting and kind of the history of wild harvest. Could you share what you know about various uses and maybe some cultural significance of seaweed? And likewise, maybe where we find seaweed as a common diet and maybe where that's at with the U.S. diet and, you know, an American diet.
Yeah, sure. So seaweed has been used for centuries in both food and non-food applications. So I'm sure you've seen, you know, on the coastline, if you go to a clam bake, folks will often use a type of kelp called rockweed, utilizing that in the clam bake. So it's more of sort of like a supporting type of form of application. So not directly consuming, but sort of helping with the cooking. Carrageenan is a component in red seaweeds that's used as a binding agent in toothpaste and other personal care products. But again, that's not found in kelp. So just some historical uses. In Japan, carrageenan, for example, has been used to dye fabrics, which then utilizes less water, because in the textile industry, they use a lot of water, potable water, which means less water for drinking. Also, some indigenous communities use seaweed as a fertilizer and even as textiles. But one thing I thought was really cool to learn when I was learning all about seaweeds was that the ancient Romans used seaweeds to treat wounds and rashes. So historically, oh, wow. Seaweeds have been a huge part of human civilization in many different ways. But in terms of consumption and food, Asians historically have and continue to consume seaweed and seaweed like value-added products, for example, pretty much daily, multiple times a day. And in fact, most of the world's seaweed products come from Asia. Seaweed is extremely nutritious. It contains a wide variety of vitamins and minerals. It's like the perfect package of food. And then places that you may have seen seaweed used in foods are like the sushi wraps, or made into the dried seaweed snacks. And you can find these in pretty much most retail grocery stores across the country. But it's important to note that those products are not made with the native seaweed species that we cultivate in the U.S. They're similar in some cases, but not the same. But in regards to American cuisine, we don't really see many American food products that contain seaweeds as just sort of being advertised as the, you know, main component of seaweed, or, you know, components have seaweed. However, there are some really innovative companies based in Maine and even on the West Coast who've been producing a lot of value-added seaweed products for decades. So, for example, Maine Seacoast Vegetables in Maine. There's Atlantic Sea Farms and Ocean's Balance, just to name a few. And Blue Evolution in Alaska are creating some really great products as well with cultivated seaweeds. But also Barnacle Foods, which uses wild harvested kelp out in Alaska as well. Another example of a new product utilizing kelp is Akua. They have a burger that incorporates seaweed into their patty. So it's not all seaweed, it's a small component, but still it's enough where it's pretty cool, I think. So it's not just like a seasoning, it's actually utilizing a lot more of the crop or the product. So while the American culinary landscape is still small, it's growing. But most importantly, I think it's more accessible with products that are easy to use and easy to find in the marketplace. And so as demand grows, meaning people have to be buying, you know, if you buy it, that really drives the demand further. So I think hopefully in the future, we'll be seeing more and more products on our store shelves that have seaweed in it.
I see. So it seems like maybe demand is kind of increasing. We've got a baseline use with like packaged seaweed items, but in terms of kind of the native harvesting and some of the maybe more like advanced type of cuisines, we're still kind of dipping our toes in.
Yeah, we're not. And I think part of the challenge is because we're importing so much of our seaweed products, And so it's really difficult to compete with the lower cost of imports. And what we're importing is also in a ready-to-use package form. And again, without the appropriate infrastructure and innovative product development, which we are being innovative and it is growing, just not as quickly as what we're importing. And so I think, again, that comes down to accessibility of domestically produced products.
Okay, so maybe we could go into this question. What type of kelp are grown in the U.S.? I guess, where are the hotspots for cultivation? And maybe outline a challenge potentially, but what are some challenges that they have for these communities?
So in the U.S., we mostly grow sugar kelp. So it's called Saccharina latissima. And that species is one of the first species that was domesticated for open water cultivation. But the great thing about sugar kelp is that it's native to our coastal waterways. So it's our native strains that we cultivate. Kelp is a cold water species, which means it needs cold water to grow. And kelp farms are seasonal. So it grows throughout the winter, harvested in late April to May. In some places, the harvest season extends to June. And kelp farms are located, especially on the East Coast. The southernmost growing range is Long Island Sound. So that's the waterway between Connecticut and New York. And then it goes up to Maine and into Canada. But on the other coast, kelp farms can be found in Alaska, Washington, and most recently in California. But there's several obstacles to the industry's expansion, and these are going to be nuanced based on location. But the primary obstacles are really access to consistent markets. And I brought it before mainly because we import 90% of our seafood, including seaweed. And so again, the competing with imports can be a challenge, especially when the products that we import are so well established that there's that expectation. If the seaweeds taste different or have a different texture, that again can be challenging for the consumer and even for wholesale purchasers in the culinary industry, for restaurants as well. There's that expectation of what they were used to using. So of course, training folks, not really training, I should say, but getting folks used to working with our native species. There's a lot of efforts working on that, but that's just going to take some time before we are at a point where we can replace what we import. But there's also other challenges, and I think this is really the most immediate priority, is ensuring access to post-harvest processing and storage infrastructure. And again, part of the reason why is that's a challenge is because on our coastal waterways, our marine aquaculture is bivalve mollusk and shellfish, and so it's oysters and clams. And we sell oysters and clams whole and live, so we're not processing the oysters and clams so much. So that really limits infrastructure, and the infrastructure that's utilized for shellfish, we can't commingle other products with it because shellfish is considered an allergen. And so it's trying to find ways to increase the shelf life or increase storage capacity beyond the short harvest season is really what presents a challenge. We also need processing and product development and just trying to figure out what the market wants, needs, how we can compete with the imported product. That's also taking some time to try and figure out where and how our farm seaweed can fit in. And to some extent, and I think this is important when talking about or thinking about climate change, is access to seed. And the reason why I bring that up is that there's some regions in the U.S., most notably southern New England, where as sea surface temperatures rise, kelp being a cold water species, it can be challenging to find the reproductive tissue out in the wild because we're still so reliant on wild sources for our reproductive tissue to bring it into the lab to then make or to produce the seed that the farmers can then grow out on their leases. And so unless the kelp can, adapt to the warming climate, that may be a challenge, I think, for the future of some parts of the seaweed producing industry. Because again, for us in Southern New England, we're noticing that migration northward to cooler waters for our kelp species. So, but again, the opportunity can open up for a new species that we can potentially cultivate. So again, it's just still a very much dynamic type of industry. It's emerging. As we're sort of trying to figure things out, we're noticing that there's new challenges that are coming up.
I was wondering if you could clarify something about processing. I'm wondering if seaweed is something that is best eaten fresh, or if there are ways to package it, like canning, or, you know, doing some kind of water bath. I guess, what are the best ways to serve and process seaweed if you can't, you know, buy it right away or can't buy it fresh, like day of?
So majority of the product for human consumption that's imported is dried and packaged. Seaweed really lends itself well to desiccation. And so when you dry seaweed and reconstitute it again, which I've done just some experiments at home, it's been pretty cool to see that. But I don't think that there's a best way. I think it's more about what I think the final product or what the market wants. Personally, I love fresh seaweed, but I also know that I can't get it year-round. And I think in order for this industry to grow, especially during the summer months when tourism is high, if you want to promote and encourage seaweed consumption, you're not going to be able to do that with fresh seaweed in the summertime because it's not available then. And so again, trying to find ways to increase shelf life, to expand the market beyond the short harvest season in any way that's possible, I think that's really what I think we need to try everything. But really, it's mostly the infrastructure and the cost of processing, like the cost of a brick and mortar structure, the cost of utilities, the cost of storage. It's all those underlying costs that folks don't think about when they are interested, especially in food manufacturing, because there's not only the product quality component that I think you have to think about, it's also the food safety.
Got it. Thanks for clarifying that.
Sure.
That's a great segue into our next block of questions about food safety, risks and hazards. Could you talk about what some risk factors associated are with cultivated seaweed?
So kelp is cultivated in the open ocean, and it's also sold raw in some states, not all. So that means water quality in that growing area can really impact the safety of the seaweed. Things like heavy metals and other chemical contaminants that come from land-based systems will be absorbed by the kelp. So in addition to heavy metals, pathogens can also pose a risk if not handled properly. And pathogens are naturally occurring in the water, so they're there. It's just a matter of making sure that their growth is mitigated to the point where it's not going to cause illnesses.
So what are those prominent pathogens and methods to mitigate risk? I know you conduct a lot of research on this topic specifically, so if you wanted to share some of, you know, your main research questions that you have and maybe also some of the findings you've had on this topic.
Yeah, sure. So some of the main pathogens of concern are mostly bacteria like Vibrio, E. coli, things like Salmonella. These are, again, naturally occurring in the environment. They're everywhere. But that means that it's important to handle the seaweed post-harvest to prevent the growth to levels that can cause illnesses. So that's really the key thing. The way the industry mitigates seafood hazard concerns like pathogens and heavy metals is to cultivate in what's called approved growing areas for shellfish, shellfish like oysters and clams. And so shellfish being filter feeders, they'll also ingest whatever's in the water. And because we're consuming it raw, like oysters in the half shell with a glass of wine, you know, you really have to make sure that the quality of the shellfish is safe. And so the U.S. has some of the highest water quality regulations in the world, which makes for very high standards for our shellfish, and by default makes very high standards for our seaweed. And so these growing areas are monitored routinely by regulatory agencies to ensure the water quality is appropriate for food production and consumption. And so again, many states require seaweed just to be grown in the same areas as shellfish. And so that sort of alleviates any of those problems and concerns because they're testing the water anyway. And so also thinking about heavy metal uptake, again, with pathogens, it's meant for heavy metal uptake. But for pathogens, ensuring that the seaweed is kept cold, it really prevents growth, right, of pathogens. And it's not only a great way to maintain food safety, but also product quality, because seaweed is mostly water. And as soon as you pull it out of the water column, it's going to begin to degrade. And so keeping it cold really maintains that great quality. And something else to consider, because kelp is cultivated during winter and spring months, the water is cold anyway. So the levels of pathogens in the water column are going to be at a minimum. So overall, I think the way we're cultivating our kelps especially is really in a food safe manner that kind of addresses all of these concerns up front. But just a little bit about my research. So I've spent 8 years addressing food safety concerns with kelp in Connecticut. And it's been through partnerships with the Connecticut Department of Agriculture, as well as some kelp farmers, to develop guidance for Connecticut kelp for food safety. And at the time, the reason why we did it was that there were no federal guidelines for kelp or for seaweed in general in terms of cultivation in open water. And then in the state of Connecticut, all aquaculture producers had to operate, or I should say have to operate, under a food safety plan. But then it's kind of hard to develop a plan if you have no guidance, but then you can't develop guidance unless you have data to justify the guidance, right? So that's what started. It's like, okay, well, let's figure out what the state's concerns are for food safety. I applied for funding. We did all the testing, and we were able to show what is a perceived concern compared to what is an actual concern. But most importantly, we were able to develop protocols and ways to manage some of these hazards so that they wouldn't be a problem. And so this guidance document, we took a HACCP approach, so a hazard analysis and critical control point approach. And if you're familiar with how HACCP works, is hazard has been identified, and then you come up with a plan to mitigate those hazards. And that should be enough to maintain food safety throughout the production and processing chain. And what's great about this project is not only we have this guidance document that's also been used as a model in other states, but also in other countries. Most importantly, it enables Connecticut farmers to be able to sell their seaweed to the final consumer. And not only just being able to sell, the state of Connecticut conducts all the testing. And so it's an additional layer of security for consumers, because now they're purchasing kelp that's been backed up by the state of Connecticut in terms of food safety. So it's an extra bonus for marketing, I think.
Wow. I didn't realize that you were so crucial to the development of those standards on the East Coast. That's really awesome.
Well, in Connecticut, but...
In Connecticut.
Still, it could be a trickle effect. I mean, it's just amazing that there just aren't certain standards for seaweed the same way there are for shellfish. And you mentioned some perceived concerns versus actual concerns that you found in your research. I was curious, you know, aside from maybe some of the pathogens you also mentioned, are there any human health hazards associated with seaweed and processing? Or, you know, vulnerable populations when it comes to any potential or actual hazards?
Not really, because beyond the grow out, the growing areas, that's really well monitored and controlled. Well, I wouldn't say controlled, but well monitored. The hazards are going to be similar to processing. But the difference with processing is that there's federal guidelines and inspections that are conducted for processing facilities that, you know, have been developed and enforced by FDA. So processing is already taken care of, and a lot of processing steps have a kill step. or preservation step that really goes above and beyond so that it really ensures, again, not only product quality, but food safety. So other than that, you know, I think there's really not much in terms of food safety other than consumer handling. You know, you open up a jar of something, you don't put it in the refrigerator. You know, that's on the consumer, but certainly not liability for the processor.
That's interesting.
I have a quick clarification question about pathogens on seaweed. So does drying or desiccation, does that count as a kill step? Or, you know, are you trying to prevent the pathogens from being in the water? And that, so like, how do you deal with it if you do identify a pathogen? Do you just not harvest or package that seaweed?
So I think it's yes. And I think it would take a lot for a pathogen, because again, they're naturally occurring. They're going to be in the water column anyway. And I think if you dry it, so I think if you leave it out in the sun on a hot day, you allow the levels of pathogen to increase and then dry it. I think it's going to depend upon what you do with that dried product. If you then consume it directly dried without adding anything else to it, that may be a problem, but that's not what most people do. If they're going to dry, they're going to dry in a food safe way and they're going to store it in a food safe way. But if it's for something that's non-food, that's not really a concern. If they're just going to use it for fertilizer or something else that, you know, if it's going to be incorporated in another type of product, if food safety is not going to be a concern. So I think it's knowing what is going to happen with the final product or at the point of sale and whether or not it's going to be used for food versus non-food. So really food safety, it, you know, if you're going to, and again, it's just going to depend upon the state, you know, it's, or where it's cultivated. It's with, if it's not going to be consumed, then I don't think food safety is going to be an issue.
Okay. That's good to know. So beyond food safety specific things, what are some other challenges or obstacles that you've seen with market development and permitting in this industry?
Yeah. So market development, again, it's going to come back to, I don't say competing with imports, but really figuring out how to make domestic seaweed rise to the top when there's so many other imported seaweed products out there. I think there's a lot of education that needs to be conducted. And I think a lot of nonprofits and farmers are working on the education component and making sure consumers are aware of the differences. It's also the price point that can also be challenging because the cost of production is going to be higher here. And, you know, there's many reasons why. It's the cost of doing business here, but also it's the food safety element and undergoing inspections, for example, that also increases the price. It's also the short growing season and harvest season that really limits market availability and market scope, or I should say market access. And also, again, understanding that what species we import are not going to be the same species that we cultivate, which means we can't necessarily use them in the same way. But I think that, you know, as long as we can also figure out ways we can process or develop new products, that would really be a great way to help address the challenge and obstacle with market development. And just sort of finding ways or just new innovative products that we can develop. Now, permitting. Permitting can be a challenge for states, I think, that are not used to having aquaculture operations in their coastal waterways that require long lines. A lot of our aquaculture are done like with shellfish. They're done in cages. They don't require long lines. They're mostly vertical in the water column. With kelp farms, the lines are going to be attached to two buoys. And so that creates really what's called a navigation hazard. And not only a navigation hazard for boaters, but also protected marine species, which can get entangled in those lines And so that is really the concern from permitting agencies. When the permitting process works correctly, the way it's supposed to work, it's supposed to find balanced uses of our coastal waterways to reduce conflicts with protected marine species and other maritime industries. So it's really important to make sure that permitting agencies and farmers have the information they need to make the best decisions as to where kelp farms can go, because nobody wants any sort of conflict. And I think that there's always a way to find balanced use and uses for our waterways. And it's not really clear cut where there's a road, or you can see the clear designation and delineation of, like, say, a cornfield, and you can clearly see the boundary lines. It's not like that under the water. And I think that also presents a challenge.
And also, is permitting kind of equal, or is it harder in some places than others to get those farms underway?
I think it's going to be harder because of the landscape and how different the different coastal areas are. So a farm application goes through a federal review, state review, multiple agency state reviews, and in some cases, in some states, local municipality reviews. And so I think it's, you know, for example, a state like Connecticut, our entire seafood production industry is really considered aquaculture. We don't have a wild capture fishery. And so our entire infrastructure, in terms of not infrastructure, but framework, is designed around aquaculture. And most of our aquaculture is done on bottom, and very now I would probably say maybe a good percentage, maybe 25-30% of our industry now utilizes some sort of gear. But otherwise it's been on bottom. And so there's not as many buoys or, you know, lines and cages historically in Connecticut as there are in other states. And so I think the challenge for some regulatory folks is if they don't have a well-established aquaculture industry that utilizes gear, they are not so sure how that is going to impact the environment. And that's really what I think the concern is how is this farm going to impact the environment? Is it going to cause a problem? So really, I think that's really the difference. But also, even in one state, the type of gear is going to depend upon what the bottom looks like. Is it a sandy bottom? Is it a muddy bottom? Is it a rock, rocky bottom? Because that's going to determine the type of gear that's needed. And it's that gear type that can function very differently in one area compared to another. And so it's very site specific, which can make it really challenging. You can't sort of impose one type of regulatory review in terms of the gear and say, this is what, the step-by-step process, because it won't translate well to all areas, even if it's in the same state or the same town. There's so many variables that have to be taken under consideration. And without there being, the environment's the environment. It's going to be different, right? Every day can be different. But I think it's without having enough data to be able to predict what can happen. I think a lot of agencies use the precautionary approach when they're thinking about whether or not they want or whether or not they can permit a farm in site A versus site B. Does that help?
Yes, definitely. It seems like there is a lot of environmental review as well as, the micro ecosystems of the sea exist as well, and the consideration of a lot of these operations.
Yeah, and I think it has to be, because we do want to expand aquaculture in the most responsible way. And we don't want to make the same mistakes that other countries have made with their coastal environment. Hmm. And I think it's important to realize that we prioritize everything, which is a good thing, I think, right? Whereas there are other countries that may prioritize food production over protected marine habitats. And for us, it's protected marine habitats and then food production. But you can't say that one way is better than the other. You know what I mean? So I think it's just trying to find that balance, which can always be tricky.
Some of the challenges you mentioned made me think about smaller seaweed producers and kind of that landscape, because, you know, Local Food Safety Collaborative, we work a lot with small producers. And I'm curious if you have any indication as to whether or not it's difficult to enter that if you are a small producer. You know, is it more, are seaweed farmers generational? Is there a big obstacle to get into the market when it seems like there's already many other obstacles to grow and to sell? Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring up the small farmers, because what we're noticing in especially Southern New England is a lot of folks that are interested in becoming seaweed farmers don't come from a maritime background. So for example, in the state of Maine, many seaweed producers work for the lobster industry. And the reason why it works so well up there is seaweed farming works so well up in Maine. It has by far the greatest number of farmers or farms in Maine than any other state has for seaweed. And so seaweed farming occurs when the lobster season, which is the primary commercial fishery for the state of Maine, seaweed farming occurs when the lobster industry or lobster season closes. And so it just is just more of a seamless transition for lobster operations, because they have a whole crew that now they can transition to working on tending the kelp lines. And then once the kelp season is over, they just retransition back into lobstering. And so it's a great way for them to sort of incorporate, or not really incorporate, but be more resilient during seasonal fishery closures. Whereas in Southern New England, the folks, it's just sort of the opposite. They're folks that are coming into the industry, not really having that seafood production background, which means it makes finding markets a bit more challenging. And so for them also, it's many of them don't come with the boater safety skills that a lot of, say, lobstermen have and a lot of the commercial fishing industry has already. And so that also presents an additional challenge, because kelp farming is done during the winter months. And nor'easter storms are pretty, you know, strong and can be dangerous. And so in terms of finding a market, while some of them are really, really great and entrepreneurial, again, it's understanding how seafood is produced and the challenges with transporting seafood and keeping it safe. These are additional obstacles, I think, for small-scale farmers. Other obstacles like social license can also be a problem for some farmers. So that's going to vary from state to state. And so social license can really delay securing permits for months, if not years. So I think it's just educating the general audiences, their neighbors, you know, ensuring that they're good stewards of the environment, working with harbor masters. So it's just one of those things of just, but also really pushing for the economic component of it. Farming is a business. And so if I always like to tell folks, make sure you have a business plan, because that shows that you are going to be contributing to the maritime economy, the coastal economy, and that could help a farmer's case in being able to secure an application or really a site to conduct kelp farming.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that's fascinating. It seems like, yeah, there's a few knowledge gaps, but I'm glad we could address that a little bit. I wanted to also go back to challenges in developing regulations. How does that look for an industry that's still emerging?
Yeah, so I think it's really the unknown. And that's really, I think, what gets folks nervous. You know, and again, taking, you know, especially for regulatory authorities, for both food safety, but also permitting, it's taking the precautionary approach. They're going to come at it from a really conservative perspective. And it's based on experiences from other industries. You know, if something can potentially pose a risk, or the activities could result in negative consequences for the environment or for public health, there's going to be hesitancy to go all in, you know, which can be frustrating, I think, for farmers. But bottom line is, if they don't have all the data to prove that, again, a concern is only perceived and not actual, they're really going to be very cautious about how to proceed. And, you know, I think it's important to have very practical expectations, work with agencies, work with researchers to figure out, you know, what the concerns are, and then find ways to, you know, either mitigate those concerns or just address them head on. And I think with food safety is one example. It's the concern is the lack of experience with regulating a food product that isn't a seafood or a produce. It's a macroalgae, and it doesn't fall under seafood HACCP with the FDA Fish and Fisheries guidance. And seaweed doesn't fall under, you know, the FSMA produce. It's not a produce and it's not a seafood. And so without knowing how to handle it, because there's no guidance specific for seaweed, that is also an additional hurdle I think that regulators struggle with. I think again, just making sure that there's data, continuing with research to ensure that, you know, the seaweed doesn't cause illnesses, folks understand how to handle it. And really, I think it's an opportunity for collaboration. So, you know, get the industry and regulators to work together. You know, because we want to expand this industry. I think it's just going to be good for everyone here in the U.S. because it's less reliant on imports. But, you know, I think it's just, there's still a lot of unknowns.
Well, maybe we can talk about something that came out of those unknowns for, you know, this sector. Could you talk a little bit about the National Seaweed Hub?
Sure. So the National Seaweed Hub was established in 2019 through funds from NOAA's National Sea Grant Program. And it was really meant as a way to serve as a science-based, non-advocate resource for all things seaweed, about the domestic seaweed industry, and providing these resources for multiple sectors, so farmers, regulators, general audiences. It's a collaboration of a total of 12 Sea Grant programs. So there's a lot of us working on this, but we wanted to make sure that the National Seaweed Hub really served as a mechanism to identify challenges, help address those challenges, share information, but also foster collaboration. And we also wanted to make sure that these resources are publicly accessible because they're paid for by taxpayer dollars. So that we want to make sure that they're in response to what the needs are, but also folks have access to them. And we've held two seaweed symposiums, one in 2020, one earlier this year in Maine in April. And it's just a way to bring people together to just sort of talk about, you know, what the next steps are, if there are any emerging concerns, and what ideas folks have to sort of take that next step forward to help the industry progress.
That's really cool that there's a bunch of researchers and universities on the case of national seaweed. I guess kind of in that line of forward future thinking, I'm wondering if you could share some of the variety of seaweed biomass uses. I know there's a lot of potential things out there, and maybe if you could distinguish in your perspective what you think is promising and what you think is maybe a lot of hype.
Yeah, so while food and value-added food products is the primary market outlet, mostly because it's the highest value commodity, there's a lot of interest in utilizing biomass, like kelp biomass, for non-food applications. So these include fertilizers, soil amendments, things like that. Because kelp has a lot of nutrients, it's good for plants as well as it is for humans. The really cool thing about kelp biomass or seaweed biomass in general is that it's a low input crop. And so it's an attractive alternative for some of the very high carbon intensive products, for example, like man-made fertilizers.
Right. Yeah.
And even if we can supplement just a portion of man-made fertilizers, as one example, utilized on land-based crops, it would reduce the carbon footprint created to produce those crops. And so thinking beyond, you know, just the food application, again, something like fertilizers could be an alternative. And seaweed-derived soil amendments are also being investigated for agricultural use because the nutrients, again, goes back to the nutrients in seaweed. It can help to increase the productivity of some of these crops. Mm-hmm. But, you know, again, with non-food applications, I think it's also important to keep in mind the cost-benefit analysis. especially for farmers, because with an increase in biomass can come a decrease in the price point. And so the, you know, with something like food and, you know, in selling raw seaweed for directly to restaurants, you know, it's a very, very high value, low volume type of market. So that's also something to consider, is the size of a farm, but then also the price point and making sure it balances out with, you know, the cost of production and then the point of sale. And again, that's why most farmers focus on the food market first, but then they'll also divert any of their unsold product or product that was harvested toward the end of the growing season, which gets kind of, you know, I don't want to say a little, you know, it's just not as, the product quality isn't as great. It's still food safe, but the product quality is, it's just not as pretty towards the end of the growing season. So they'll divert a lot of that unsold kelp to non-food uses. But again, they're getting a fraction of in terms of price than what they would get for food. I also think it's important to consider, you know, the farming capacity of a site. It's also the labor and harvesting the kelp and where you're going to store it. So these are just very practical things to consider. There's research looking at utilizing kelp for biofuels, but again, that's still in the research stage. And also things like biotextiles and bioplastics and biopackaging. Again, it's there's some startups like Sway and Lalaware that are producing some compostable seaweed-derived textiles and products, I should say. But again, it's scale-up. That's a challenge. A lot of these require biorefineries, a lot of these applications, which we just don't have. And so that really, I don't want to say it's hype, we're just not there yet. But then we have to think about, where is the biomass going to come from? Is it going to come from these small-scale farmers? Probably not. And I think while a lot of the biomass is estimated, we still need really good numbers on being able to translate that so that a farmer can make that decision of, can I deploy 5 long lines, or should I deploy 5 long lines, or can I deploy 20? But then in deploying this 20 long lines, how is he or she going to harvest all of that product? And so again, I think it's just a lot of trying to figure out, you know, what's best for the size of farm that a farmer has or is thinking about starting.
Yeah, that's very interesting. The balance of producing, but not overproducing, it seems, so that it lowers the price too much. That seems like a fine dance there. I want to talk more about, kind of in the climate change vein you were talking about, I think it's interesting if you consider that the seaweed can filter out things like nitrogen and, you know, carbon, in addition to like replacing some of those fertilizers that are polluting waterways with those like overabundance of nutrients. Are there other ways that seaweed might be able to help adapt to climate change and do less damage than some of the current modes of operating are?
So I think really is like what you said, it's trying to find or sort of replacing some of these really high carbon intensive types of products that we utilize pretty much daily. The thing about seaweed is that it is produced in a very responsible way in harmony with the environment. So it's native. We're not bringing something that doesn't belong in our coastal. It grows in the waters that it is being cultivated in. And I think it's just a natural next step to sort of cultivate a crop, use its biomass in ways where we can supplement, you know, very high carbon intensive products. So really, I think that in terms of addressing or adapting, not really addressing climate change, but adapting to a changing climate, I think that's one of the ways seaweed can really, really help out to sort of help meet our goals, for example, for, you know, just trying to be more environmentally friendly.
On the flip side of the coin, is there a lot of threat to the seaweed species because of climate change or rising sea levels?
So not so much rising sea levels yet. And rising sea levels, I think, would be more of a challenge for the infrastructure that supports any sort of coastal maritime industry. But the rising sea surface temperatures is really what is concerning, especially for kelp. And I think I talked a little bit about that earlier. But yeah, so I think really that for us in southern New England, that's a concern. But there is research being conducted by Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, University of Southern California, I believe, and Bigelow Labs. And it's being funded by Department of Energy, I think a little bit by USDA, in looking at crossbreeding more temperature-resistant strains of kelp to produce a more temperature-resistant strain. And that would be really, really helpful and beneficial, I think, for our Southern New England industry. Because one, if we... hopefully when we get to that point where we, one, won't have to rely on wild stocks for our source tissue, for our reproductive tissue, we can go to a gene bank and get the seed stock that's needed. And hopefully that seed stock will be more temperature resistant. That would be great if we can then sort of, you know, make sure that our Southern New England industry is going to be more resilient to climate change, especially if the industry does expand and there are established markets. And so it'll just provide another opportunity for our Southern New England kelp farmers to be able to access those markets in 20, 30 years. So fingers crossed that happens.
It's good people are looking ahead. That's definitely comforting.
As people look to seaweed as an emerging industry, do you have any advice or words of caution to growers that want to incorporate kelp into their operations or aquaculture operations? Any advice about people that want to get into the business of kelp?
Yes. And I think that you just said the word business. Have a business plan. Have a business plan. Make sure it's realistic. Make sure it's practical. Know your upfront costs so you know how much to charge for your kelp and the value of your kelp. I think it's really important to establish the market and secure contracts before putting any kelp in the water. Agreeing to a price. And it's really important, you know, that way that you have a guaranteed buyer for the end of the growing season. There's a lot of farmers that have the intention of putting kelp in the, you know, when they put kelp in the water, like, oh, I'll find a farmer or a buyer. And they have a whole bunch of kelp that they don't know what to do with. That's the worst case, I think, scenario. Well, actually, no, the worst case scenario is that it doesn't grow. But again, it's just smart business planning. I know there's a lot of farmers that rely on grant funding or subsidies. I would say don't do that. Try and, you know, their subsidies are great for startups, temporary, but they're really not reliable in the long term. And I think it's important to determining what makes your business different, but where I think this business fits into the larger scheme of seafood production in general. Again, being self-sufficient, right, as a business. And if for someone who already has a maritime business, like a shellfish farm, I think it's just a matter of making sure that the site is appropriate where long lines and that type of gear that may be different from shellfish gear is an appropriate site and that your site is permitted for that type of gear. But then working with your regulatory agency to make sure that that's appropriate, I think that's the way to go. But also looking ahead in terms of knowing what your market wants, what are the types of product forms? And then that can also help in determining or balancing that with any limitations that you may have, right? So if you are, you know, it's understanding what the current market or what market currently exists, like what are the price points? Do I want to sell my kelp fresh? If so, you know, what is my capacity? Do I need, what are my limitations, I should say? Like, do I need a walk-in refrigerated unit to keep my seaweed cold? Do I need a refrigerated truck? Also, am I going to be drying it? If so, what are the food safety regulations around that? Do I need to get extra licensing or certifications? Am I going to sell to a processor? Do I have a landing facility, a storage facility? Seafood safety training. Like these are all these different things that, you know, I think that someone needs to take under consideration and really think about how that fits in again to their capacity, but most importantly, upfront costs. That's, I think, a component that a lot of folks don't think about when they get involved until they're kind of like, you know, a few years into the hole and they're like, oh my goodness, this is probably not working out. So I think these are just basic questions on business planning. And it's just being patient, allowing the time to kind of figure this stuff out before you get started.
Well, I'm calling from Texas, so I feel like after this conversation, I'm dying to come see some of these operations and just see what it takes to complete and to run an operation like this. It would be a dream to come visit that someday.
Well, you're more than welcome. Just dress really, really warmly because it's cold. It's really cold.
Yeah, I got to get my bibs on for sure.
Layers, lots of layers.
I have a question kind of jumping off of what Haley was just saying. I know, you know, ideally in the future development of these markets, there are people outside of the coastal areas that are eating seaweed. I'm wondering, are there opportunities for people, say, like, what if someone in Kansas wants to start a kelp business? Like, what do those prospects look like? And are they realistic? Or do you think that, you know, do you see most of this production and processing and consumption happening kind of along coastal areas?
So to be honest with you, it's going to be mostly in coastal areas. However, that does not preclude someone from cultivating in a tank-based system.
Interesting.
But the species that they would cultivate in a tank are going to be different. You cannot cultivate sugar kelp in a tank. So in Oregon, for example, they cultivate dulse primarily, which is a red seaweed, high protein, the bacon of the sea. It's delicious. Dulse is primarily cultivated to feed abalone, which is a highly prized shellfish. However, humans can eat dulse. So there's an opportunity again for cultivating in a tank. If you can make the costs work, because the cost of production in a tank-based system, a land-based facility, is going to be so much higher than cultivation out in the coastal environment. Because now you need to bring in water, you need to heat or cool the water, you need lights. So your utilities or, you know, cost of utilities are going to increase dramatically. You need that brick and mortar facility. So property taxes, rent, anything else that you would need to sort of rent that facility. And then again, undergo any sort of inspections, especially for food safety. And then making sure at the end of that growing or the production process that the price point will generate a profit. So that's the only thing to consider.
Yeah. Maybe not as easy as starting in the sea, for sure.
Yeah.
Haley, do you have any more questions?
No, I don't think so. I think this has been such an amazing conversation. It makes me really crave some seaweed. We got to try some actually when we were in Minneapolis. We went to Awami, the indigenous restaurant, and we tried a few different types of seaweed there. I couldn't remember the last time I'd had fresh seaweed like that, if ever. So I'm definitely craving something salty after this.
Yes.
It really tasted like the sea.
The brininess.
It really
did. Yeah, that's amazing.
Yep.
Yeah. Anushka mentioned that there's this company called Barnacle Foods at the beginning of our conversation. They're based out of Alaska. I'm based in Oregon, so I have access to some of the stuff that is probably more accessible. It's easier to find the Alaskan stuff, but there's this really awesome kelp hot sauce that I love. I'll have to mail you some. Sometime.
That's and you can get it online. And that's, you know, another thing to consider is, you know, if you're not in an area that's where you have seaweed farms locally, go online to all these different websites, these companies' websites, and you can buy stuff right off their website. It's great.
Yeah, I definitely am going to message you, Anushka, about some places for some kelp and seaweed products. So I'm excited.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, Anushka, do you have any final seaweed fun facts or sentiments to leave with our listeners?
I just said a little bit earlier, but buy local, you know, buy domestically produced seaweed products.
Yeah.
You know, if you're, again, in the seaweed producing state, go to those farmers, purchase seaweed directly from them. find restaurants that serve local kelp. And if they don't, then, and they serve another type of kelp, then just say, hey, or seaweed, say, hey, you know, why don't you serve some domestically produced seaweed in these dishes? But then we also have some seaweed festivals across the country. So, for example, the first seaweed festival was started in Maine, and it's Maine Seaweed Week. We also in Southern New England have the New England Kelp Harvest Week, and these occur in April. And in California, they started the California Seaweed Festival a few years ago. So just even going to these festivals to support local seaweed businesses, it really shows potential investors that not only is there an interest, but folks are willing to spend their money in traveling to these festivals, purchasing products directly from the vendors at these festivals. And hopefully that will encourage them to invest in things like much needed infrastructure and product development. So, you know, it's great to say, you know, I think seaweed is great. I support it. But it's another thing to really, you know, to make an impact to actually purchase domestic seaweed products. So that's what I would encourage your listeners to do is buy.
Absolutely.
That's so cool. I definitely want to go to one of those festivals. That sounds like a dream. I would buy as much as I could fit.
Yeah, probably. No, the California Seaweed Festival is usually in October, September or October. And then the East Coast, our seaweed festivals on the East Coast are in April.
Ooh. We'll have to link some of these things in the description. All the places you mentioned.
Oh, yes,
thanks
totally.
So much for that, Anushka.
Sure.
Yeah. And we didn't really mention anything about like the beauty industry, but do you want to say anything quickly on how seaweed and like cosmetics and potentially if there's, you know, big valuations for beauty products down the line?
So personal care products, like for example, carrageenan, they are incorporated, right? They come from seaweeds and they are incorporated into a lot of products. There are a few domestic companies that provide products that they make themselves with seaweed in them. And one is Soul Sea out in on the West Coast. I believe they're in Washington. There are a couple of companies in Maine. I think one is Everything Seaweed. And again, those are more domestic suppliers, local suppliers of products. But the thing about seaweed and personal care is, again, we need that infrastructure to transition the raw biomass into the components that can then be put into cosmetics and personal care products. And when a lot of these components are shipped to the US or shipped or exported, you know, imported, exported to be able to be incorporated into personal care products, they come in like vats of goo and paste and like powders. So they are, again, processed in a form that can be easily transported, but they look nothing like the seaweed that we pull out from the ocean. And so that's something else to keep in mind, is making sure that processing facilities are available to then transition that all that biomass into something that's usable.
Very cool. Well, Anushka, thank you so much for being a guest on the Food Safety Dish. This has been such a really wonderful conversation. I've learned a lot. And Haley, I think maybe you've learned a thing or two.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting being so far removed from the aquaculture that the Northeast has. So I am walking away feeling really curious. And super thankful to have someone like you who's got this amazing perspective on food safety and an emerging sector. It's been a really wonderful conversation. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you again for inviting me.
Of course. Yes. I hope we all get to see the seaweeds that we wish to see in the world in larger abundance. I know I'm going to go find some seaweeds probably at my local store to try to snack on
again,
later
on. So. Online.
You can always get online.
Don't forget.
Local Food Safety Collaborative is a cooperative initiative established between the National Farmers Union Foundation and the FDA, with the goal of providing training, education, and technical assistance to local food producers to ensure good food safety practices and compliance with the Food Safety Modernization Act. You can find us on social media at Local Food Safety and let us know topics or guests you'd like to hear from. National Farmers Union is a grassroots farmer-driven organization that believes strong family agriculture is the basis for thriving communities. NFU's membership includes over 230,000 family farmers and ranchers across America. Farmers Union's grassroots structure promotes locally initiated policy priorities and educational topics established by their members. If you're interested in learning more about NFU and the work that we do, come on, check out our website at www.nfu.org. And finally, thank you to our sponsor. This podcast is supported by the Food and Drug Administration of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services as a part of a financial assistance award 2U01FD006921-04, totaling $1 million with 100% funding by FDA-HHS. The contents are those of the authors and do not necessarily represent the official views of, nor an endorsement by FDA-HHS or the U.S. government. I'm Catherine Cavanaugh, and this has been the Food Safety Dish. See you next time.